continue our deliberations with FICE, and I give the floor to Juni.
Apologies for the delays. Today we have one agenda paper to discuss, agenda paper number 5, and that paper is about the fixed-for-fixed condition, classification of the financial instrument that is settled with the entity's own equity. And the paper sets out the way staff are approaching the issue and the staff's preliminary thoughts on what the board could do. And at this meeting today, we are not asking the board to make any decisions, but we would find it very helpful if we could get board members' comments on the direction that we are taking so that we can further develop the principles, and at future meeting the staff will bring back an analysis of further developed version of clarified principles and how it would apply to common practice problems. So with that, I will now hand over to Angie to tee up the paper.
Thanks, Juni. Good morning, board members. So at the October 2019 board meeting, the board discussed the project plan for the FICE project, and in particular, the board discussed the practice issues that it could address in the scope of the project and an indicative project timeline outlining the expected commencement of board deliberations on each issue. The objective of this paper is to begin the board's discussion on the classification of financial instruments that will or may be settled in an issuer's own equity instruments, and for both derivative and non-derivative instruments. So in particular, the staff explore what clarifications could be made to the underlying principle of the fixed-for-fixed condition, and we understand that this is one of the main sources of accounting challenges in practice and arguably one of the most difficult challenges to solve. So in developing potential clarifications, the staff first considered the current requirements and rationale in IS 32, including the history of how the fixed-for-fixed condition was developed. And this is summarized in paragraphs 8 to 17 of the paper. In paragraphs 18 to 25 of the paper, the staff discussed various questions that have arisen in practice about what fixed means and whether there are particular types of variability that do not violate the fixed-for-fixed condition. Practice questions can broadly be categorized into two different types. So there's questions on how a requirement in IS 32 should be interpreted and applied in practice. And then there's questions on the appropriateness of the outcome, even if the requirement in IS 32 is clear. In paragraphs 26 to 42 of the paper, the staff present an analysis of proposed clarifications to the principle underlying the fixed-for-fixed condition. And we would like to highlight that these clarifications would be in the form of additional guidance and would not replace the fixed-for-fixed condition. And we'd also like to point out that the analysis is made from the issuer's perspective, as it's the issuer's economic position that matters. So in summary, building on the current requirements and rationale in IS 32, the board could consider clarifying that a derivative on own equity that meets the fixed-for-fixed condition should have a fair value on the settlement date that is affected by fluctuations in the price of the underlying equity instruments and not affected by fluctuations in other variables. In addition, many financial instruments that are settled in the issuer's own equity instruments, especially derivatives, are subject to adjustments, either to the amount of cash or another financial asset, or the number of equity instruments to be exchanged, or to both. And if the board is of the view that some particular types of adjustments would not preclude the derivative meeting the fixed-for-fixed condition, the board could consider clarifying which adjustments they would accept. And at this stage, the staff are considering two types of such adjustments. The one would be what we call preservation adjustments that preserve the relative economic interests of the derivative holder and the underlying equity instrument holder. And number two is what we call passage of time adjustments that solely compensate the issuer for the fact that the derivative will be settled at a future date. In paragraphs 43 to 52 of the paper, the staff discuss non-derivative instruments that are settled in own equity instruments, and we believe that clarifying the principle underlying the fixed for fixed condition and determining what is a fixed number of own equity instruments will also affect the classification of non-derivatives, which is based on there being no obligation for a variable number of shares. So the staff therefore do not believe that any additional clarifications are needed to the requirements for classifying non-derivative instruments. Lastly, in paragraph 53 to 63 of the paper, the staff explore how the proposed clarified principle would apply to some of the practice issues identified. We'd like to ask board members whether they have any comments or questions on the staff's proposed clarifications. And I'll now turn the discussion over to the board members.
Sue.
Firstly, thank you for the paper. I like it, and I like your proposals in here. So I've just got a couple of drafting suggestions and a couple of things I think we need to think about and develop a little bit further. So, firstly, the easy one, the drafting suggestion. I think that if you look at the words that we've got in paragraph 27, which are then in this in the recommendation, I agree with what you've got here, but would suggest that we delete the word only in 27A, because I think we definitely want the value of the settlement value to be affected by the fluctuation, and we all and it's more clear if you don't have the word only that it has to be affected by it, and we've already got the protection of only because of what you've got in B, so I think it would be clearer if we delete the word only. One thing I was interested in the paper, which is probably slightly different to how I've thought about it in the past, but I agree with it, is the fact that you're focusing on the effect from the issuer's perspective. So it's not what the holder's perspective is, but more what are the sort of risks of the issuer. And that made me pause for a while, but on reflection, I agree with that, because I think typically when we think about classification of things as equity or liabilities, we're asking, are there obligations on the issuer, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it is correct to use the issuer perspective. A couple of things to think about. If you look at paragraph 28, we're sort of saying that our sort of comparison, if I understand you correctly, is what would the risks be for the issuer if they'd already issued ordinary shares? And I think that is a useful way of thinking about it. But I think we need to be a little bit careful, because I think there are some risks that they are exposed to that are different. They don't cause me to think about it differently, but in terms of being very clear, because we have to be clear, we're going away from fix for fix, which isn't clear enough, so whatever we come up with has to be able to be bulletproof if it can be. I think there's at least maybe three risks I can think of that they are exposed to that they wouldn't be if they'd actually issued shares. One is the credit risk of the counterparty, because they may need to receive cash. One is the time value of money, because they're going to get paid later rather than today. And the third one would be liquidity risk, because they're going to have to wait for cash. There might be others, so I think we need to think a little bit more. I think that analogy is sort of nice, but it's probably a little bit too simplistic relative to what we need to deal with derivatives. The other thing I think that we need to think about a little bit, again, I agree with where you're going, but I think we need to think about, is the passage of time adjustments. So I think you could read this and assume that it means that as long as something's only going to happen adjusted for passage of time, it's always going to be okay. I'm not sure if we mean that, strictly speaking. Mm-hmm. And the silly example that I used myself when I was trying to stress test my thinking would be, let's say that you've got a choice of buying, I don't know, 5 shares, and you can pay, you know, in a year or 2 years or 3 years, and the amount that you're going to pay is going to be different. It's going to be more if it's later. Mm-hmm. I'd be fine if it was just an adjustment sort of for, I don't know, current 1 year, 2 year, 3 year interest rate. But what if the adjustment was 5 times the interest rate? Mm-hmm. I presume that leverage has got some sort of change in how we'd think about it. So I think we need to be careful what we mean by this passage of time concept. But I agree with where you're heading. I think it's a good analysis. Thank you.
Adele.
Thank you, Hans.
That's a very, very good paper. I really enjoy it. I think that paragraph 32 defines where we are in terms of whether we go for a more radical view of never change, or we could develop a principle to open the possibility. And I think that we should go in this way. In relation to the passage of time adjustment, especially in my case that I have still some inflation culture, I think that it really makes a difference if we consider the passage of time in countries where you have higher inflation, not necessarily hyperinflation, because it's together with the interest rate. It's just a matter of compensation. It's a combination of the preservation, adjustment, the passage of time. That's I think that's quite helpful. In paragraph 38, we discuss down round feature. And in paragraph 41, we talk about event of a change in control of the issuer. In both cases, the down round feature and the change in control issue that could trigger a change in the instrument, the strike price, I think that if they have a protective meaning, I think that we can manage to encounter a principle that would allow it. What I'm trying to say is that for the down round feature, for example, if there is a subsequently issue of ordinary shares, actually the current shareholders are doing this. It's not just a transaction that is happening at the market. They did it. They provoke it. And then could be protective, this down round feature. Just thinking about that. It's not just because I'm changing, but I'm trying to protect. The same case for the event of changing control of the issuer. Supposing that there is a tag-along clause, if I don't have this one, I would be the only one not getting the tag-along right, while the current shareholders, they would. That's, I think, that I like the principle. Mm-hmm. But we should also think about the case where these clauses are added with the intention of protecting, not actually getting rid of the equity risk. That's it. Thank you.
Jen Chao.
Thank you. First, I appreciated the analysis. The paper is a very good paper. I think it's clarified the underlying principle of fixed-to-fixed condition. Because sometimes people apply fixed-to-fixed condition, you know, focus on the forms rather than substance. But once we clarify the principles, it will help us look at the substance of those financial instruments rather than forms. So it really help us also help to, you know, to clarify those adjustments, particularly the you know, preservation adjustment and the passage of time adjustment could be included, you know, and our principle could be qualified as fixed to fixed condition. I think it's very important. I think current approach also more understandable comparing to discussion papers proposal. That's whether obligation is, you know, independent of available economic resources or not. But currently, we are focused on the fluctuation in the price of the underlying equity instruments. It's very easy to judge whether it is or not. Based on Sue's mention about the wording of paragraph 27A, I also have one suggestion, because currently we focus on the price of the underlying equity instrument. But the term of the underlying equity instrument is very important. But it seems that we didn't define what's the meaning of the underlying, you know, equity instrument. So in my understanding, this underlying equity instrument should be issues all underlying equity instrument.
Yes, that's right.
So not others, as Ms. Su had not told, from ECU's perspective, but ECU's own equity instrument, because sometimes maybe ECU is subsidiary and there is a parent. Mm. So it's better to make it clear what's the meaning of the underlying equity instrument. But I'm not, just to check whether my understanding
equity
is correct.
Equity from the reporting entity's perspective, yes?
That's or maybe right. The reporting, I think it's very important, because sometimes there are derivative linkage to different kind of underlying equity instruments, but what kind of equity instruments we mention here, I think very important. So just one comment on
that. Just to make sure we're all on the same wavelength. So if we said it was we mean own equity, but it's the reporting entity's perspective.
That's
so
right.
In the parent's standalone, it would have to be their own shares, but in the consolidated accounts, it could be the shares of a subsidiary.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
That is the parent's consolidated financial standing level.
It
from
could be
that
the subsidiaries, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From in its own accounts, it would have to be its own shares.
That's right.
Nick.
Thank you. So just a couple of points to pick up on. And likewise, thank you for the paper. Very helpful indeed. So I think the foundation, as Sue highlighted, is the emphasis is on the perspective of the issuer or the entity, if you like. But clearly, we draw on a couple of times through the paper, one in terms of the foreign currency exception, foreign currency rights issue exception that we have, and also through talking about preservation exceptions, we almost go back to looking at the perspective of the equity holder rather than necessarily the perspective of the entity. And I think we just need to be clear how we separate those two out, that our starting point is the entity, but when we come to look at some of these exceptions, it brings in some different issues there. And the reason why I mentioned this, just thinking about in preparation for this, clearly, there are a number of entities where you have a functional currency which isn't the same as the currency the share price is quoted in. And from the perspective of an equity holder, I could make an argument actually it'd be much better to have an option that was issued in the currency of the share price rather than the functional currency. Actually, you then do have economically a known amount, whereas in the functional currency, you would still have some variability because you're always going to have to convert back to that share price at some stage. So I think it's just about getting that emphasis and the clarity around that the foundation is the issuer perspective, but we then use some other perspectives in terms of thinking about the exceptions. The second area, and again, I may have a different view here from others, but I think we just need to, again, go away and think about it. Because when I thought about the passage of time, I wasn't so comfortable that we were mixing that up with the time value of money. I thought we were conflating two things that I'm not sure were related, but clearly others in the room feel like they want to relate those very closely. And so I think we just need to go away and think about what we want to do there. And I guess it comes into play in particular when we start to think about Bermudan options, which I have to confess I'd never heard about until I read this paper, and whether those could be thought of as a series of separate options that have just simply been packaged together, or whether there's something above and beyond that in a Bermudan option. But I think those are all questions around, you know, what do we mean by the passage of time? Is it simply and strictly the time value of money, or is it just life has moved on one way or another?
That's right. I think just to on that point, I think at this stage we are testing the idea. So we know that passage of time is a little bit a loose word, if you like. But at this stage, we want to see the board's appetite first. And then I think we are certainly planning to tighten it so that it's not just any variation with time. We didn't mean that, but we will make it more specific at the future meeting.
Thank you. Mary?
On the theme of giving you feedback, board initial reaction like others, first of all, compliments for starting with the most difficult, what's likely to be the most difficult area. And it's a chunky but I think very thoughtful paper and good analysis. And I'm going to start where a couple of other people started in paragraph 27, because inevitably, comments range across a range of issues if you're asking for reactions on everything. I had a similar reaction to Sue in terms of thinking about A versus B here and how they overlapped or may be consistent or inconsistent. And frankly, my first reaction had been that we should be thinking in terms of the wording of B about not only saying you're only affected by the same risk, and that kind of goes back to that notion of if you had issued the instrument today rather than a derivative on the on the instrument. And what I'm thinking about is the terms of the derivative shouldn't be able to give leverage that is disproportionate to what you would have if you had issued the underlying instrument. It could be both the derivative and the and the entity and therefore the underlying share could be exposed pretty, you know, could be exposed to a particular risk, let's say a commodity risk. But if the terms of the option leveraged it, that's a feature of the option that isn't a feature of the underlying. So I think we'd have to, if we keep be thinking about quantum as well as type, but then the more you look at B versus A, if you kept the word only in A, I think A is maybe the only criterion that we need. And then B becomes almost more an observation about the consequence of that first criterion. And I don't think we should try and decide it today. I think both of these thoughts are relevant for giving context to the specific fixed for fixed requirement that exists and that you said we plan to keep. But it's a question of how we're going to supplement it, give it context, give it clarification. So I'd say think about whether it's A only with B as an explanation, or if we keep B as a criterion that has to be addressed. Sue's comment about then the knock-on wording for A, but also thinking about quantum in that one. So that's probably my biggest kind of conceptual point, apart from saying I think it's really helpful to bring the clarity about it. This is all an analysis from the issuer's perspective, and as Nick mentioned, there are times when we might say do the analysis by thinking about whether the holder of the instrument, whether it's proportionate, et cetera. But I think we always have to link it back to the issuer so we don't create confusion or mixed signals. And I think we are saying, yes, it is the issuer perspective. And then I think we have to be very disciplined about being consistent with that. Like Sue, I had started to think, though not as clearly, about some of the acceptable risks that are specific to the derivative but not the underlying equity instrument, and choose better than I was at naming what some of them might be. And I wouldn't want to create problems because that I wouldn't want to preclude equity classification because, for example, you had credit risk with respect to the exercise price of an option. Mm-hmm. So I think it's right to think about that category of things. And also, like Sue, when you get to the issue of what did you call them, the preservation adjustments, I was concerned that it came across as sounding like anything that is specified as long as it's stepped, as long as you meet this mechanical pattern, you're going to be okay. Yeah. I think Nick's point is a really good one in terms of we have to say, what's your benchmark for assessing the reasonableness of the adjustment? But I think if you reflect on what Tadeo said about thinking about high inflation environments, I think it is important that not be a barrier to equity classification, because you can understand from the issuer's perspective why that's a reasonable adjustment, but you can also understand how somebody could use the mechanic to build in leverage that is not consistent with holding the underlying share. So I think we're going to have to think hard about how we express that. When I come to another comment that Tadeo made, I'm not sure that I agree about there should be there may be an underlying concept or principle that would support down round adjustments as not precluding equity classification. My instinct had been that down round was a problem, but it wasn't until you did the analysis in this paper that I could see a line of analysis that explained how those were differentiated from other, I keep forgetting, whatever the preservation adjustments. So, again, I just wanted to offer maybe a contrast to today's comments on down round, because I think you explained from the issuer's perspective that the issuer is responsible for the consideration that benefits one group of shareholders and not all. Although I do think we can, there's maybe a line we have to draw about acceleration in terms of change in control. If it's changing the exercise date, you know, if changing control term triggers an acceleration of the ability to exercise, let's say, an option. I keep using an option as my basic form of derivative thinking about these things. That, to me, feels more like a preservation adjustment. But then if it also requires the company to cash out, like to cash out for cash, as opposed to making it eligible to be bought out by the acquirer, mm-hmm. in changing control, it raises questions because that then becomes a contingent cash settlement mm-hmm. requirement. So again, I think we'll have to think hard about how we express some distinctions that we're making. It's just not anything that's changing control is okay, but there are certain things that might be typical for changing control that I think we should think about providing some guidance on. And then the last thing, Sue's last comment touched, in response to Jing Zhao, touched briefly on the whose perspective, you know, the separate financial statements or the group. I think there may be some extra credit added complexities when we start thinking about the separate financial statements of an entity within a group. And it might be helpful if we did the initial round being very clear about what perspective we had mm-hmm. and doing the analysis from that perspective and then going back and saying, okay, does something change if you look at it from the separate financial statement perspective, kind of the way you did the non-derivative after you walked through the derivative section. But on the whole, I think you have you're looking at something that I think has the potential for being a way forward that's consistent with the overall project direction, mm-hmm. and it's not going to be, you know, I worry that at a high level it might appear easier than it will be when you start to actually draft, but I think good thinking and hopeful that it's a constructive way forward.
So a couple of points and a question. I think to weigh in on the 27A, 27B discussion, I had initially when I'd read the paper thought that 27B was redundant and wondered why it was there, which I think Mary was a little bit where you were heading. I like Sue's idea of striking out the only because that gave both a purpose to A and B, and I think it makes A clearer in terms of what we're trying to get at. So I think that's probably a drafting thing, but I thought that was a useful addition. Where I'd struggled a little bit is paragraph 34, and I think this is in the context of the preservation adjustment. And the way that we describe a preservation adjustment is an adjustment that preserves the relative economic interest of the derivative holder and the underlying equity instrument holder, and I like that works for me. But when I actually read it, I thought, well, hang on a second, if that's our objective, then surely the absence of these preservation adjustments means that I'm not preserving that relative balance between the two. Now, I know that the way we set this up is we've said that the trigger mechanism to even consider this is an adjustment. If there's not an adjustment, we don't even think it. But I think it's just worth making sure we're comfortable that if I, for example, don't have dilutive protection or I don't have passage of time in a Bermudan option, then in theory I'm not getting that preservation. I'm favoring now the existing shareholder over the new one, and it's just worth thinking about on that one. And then it picks up a little bit on Nick's point about the discussion on issuing your own shares in your non-functional currency. So I'd understood from the context of the paper that we intend keeping the exception for when the holding company issues in its own functional currency. I wasn't clear when the subsidiary issues in its functional currency and that functional currency is different to the holding company's functional currency. I wasn't clear whether that was the application of our requirements or an exception to our requirements. Now, I think you've explained to me that it was the application of our requirements, but I think we perhaps just need to be clearer in that.
Okay. Gary.
Thank you. By the way, I thought a very good set of papers. I'm with you on the direction of travel you're going and appreciate the devil might be the details later on. And I do agree with a lot of the earlier comments, and using a different choice of words, Daryl largely said what I was going to say. But I think having dealt with a lot of these things in prior life, one thing I do come back to learn, no matter how you write the accounting standards, people who create financial instruments are very good at getting around, barriers, whether it's a tax barrier, an accounting barrier, or whatever, and I don't care if it's in 32 or a 9, 39 context. So the way to, I think, to approach it, you need one of these foundational overarching principles that's hard, you know, to be interpreted. And I think the first paragraph, or excuse me, the first sentence in paragraph 37 really, to me, sort of nails it, is adjustments that favor the derivative holder at the expense of the underlying equity holder are not preservation or time value adjustments. I mean, that's really it. I could probably expand that and say adjustments that favor or disadvantage the derivative holder versus the equity holder are not these adjustments. That's the ground, that's the foundational principle that you're trying to get to in here. And that's clear, it's in plain language, and it's hard to work yourself around it if you default back to something like that. And I think in paragraph maybe 26 or 27, I think you keep coming back to that. But I would make that's the principle and the objective and the default mechanism, and then everything else is details underneath that. Because once you start going to details is where as product designers, you know, go to work.
I think just on that point on favors or disadvantage the derivative holder, I think for the latter we are still thinking about it, because I think as Daryl mentioned just now, if the derivative is fixed or fixed and not subject to adjustment, you could arguably say that if any dilutive event occurs and there is no adjustment to the derivative, you could say that derivative holder is less favorable position than the new shareholders. But if it's strictly fixed or fixed and you know exactly how many shares you are going to issue and how much cash you are going to receive, then we wouldn't say that that's not equity just because the derivative holder is in a less favorable position.
Well, nothing is strictly fixed for fixed, or we wouldn't be having this discussion today.
Yes, we know that, but so in terms of how do we think about that, I think we are still exploring.
Because I think we were thinking of some of those equity instruments where you could end up in the worst position. So you're taking the first loss, for example, when your instrument is written off. And it sort of feels strange to say that from an issuer's perspective, if I've issued an instrument where the holder is so far disadvantaged from my other equity holders because they take the first loss, that creates a liability on my side. Because I've written this great equity instrument that absorbs so much loss that my other equity holders don't have to absorb the loss. Why does that sort of create a financial liability on my side as the issuer because I was so bright in doing that? Mm. And I think that's one of the things we were thinking of. So the easy one is to say, well, if the derivative holder is more advantaged, then clearly that feels
and maybe
like
it is just advantaged. I kind of see it as a symmetrical world, and it cuts your relative value either increase or decrease. I mean, I wouldn't, if you think it's only an advantage, they wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. That was just a initial reaction that fixed for fixed means there's no changes in relative value, and either, you know, change can move in either direction from either side, still a change. If you think it really should stay with advantage, we'll stay with that. But again, it wasn't necessarily the, you know, a deep drill down into thinking, it's just a symmetrical type perspective. Yep. And I think you're saying it'd be asymmetrical.
Well,
or could be.
Could be. I mean, that's part of what we're still thinking about. We'll come back to that.
Tom?
Yeah, there's so much here. I'll try and just maybe do the major ones. So first of all, in A and B, I just kind of encourage us, if we are going to focus on the issuer, then it is important. So in B, where we say that the holder, and then the subsequent paragraph we say as the issuer, and so we need to be always very clear when we mean holder and when we mean issuer.
Yep.
So just to be clarify, in B, even though we were taking the issuer's view, you still mean holder, right?
Yep.
And so when we explain this, we have to be very clear to people. I guess the second one is probably is this, how do we stress test what we're going to do? And I think if I went to paragraph 57, I think Kautz sort of has the key thing in it. Yeah, where you say this is the crux of what we'll face when we stress test it. So you say a foreign currency convertible bond, etc. Where am I? Sorry, no, it's 58. I apologize. The last sentence says, concerns arise because accounting for the foreign currency conversion option as a financial liability at fair value through means that both gains and losses from the changes in the foreign exchange rates and gains and losses on own equity will be recognized in profit or loss. And what you're doing, and I like what you've done in the way you've laid it out, is you're trying to keep the gains and the things that if the equity moves, we don't want those movements into profit or loss fundamentally. Right? And so we have that, and I think the way you've done it quite tightly. It's going to keep most other noise out. And where it gets hard is as another element comes in. So just like you have in that paragraph, you have now a second source of gains and losses. And so we now are in a situation, if I made it negligible, suppose 1% of the gains and losses came from something, I don't care what, and 99% came from the movements in equity. Would we still want to call that a liability and run all those equity gains and losses through profit and loss? If I made it 0.1 of 1%. And this is where I think there's the problem arises is people will say, that's ridiculous. 0.1 of 1% is coming from variable X, and you're going to run all these variability of equity through profit or loss. So I think you're doing the right thing, but I think anything we do, I would go and stress test for possible other variables that can come in, because I think that's where people will come back and say, you know, you've got it wrong. You're running all these equity gains. And so I think the stress testing is a huge one. I think that's, yeah, it's all for now.
This might be unhelpful, so I apologize. I think it's probably important we think about it, and it's Nick's comment that made me ponder this as I sit here. So I think we need to be, and it might be this sort of starting anchor that we're trying to use for our thinking, which to me feels like a good anchor, but let's make sure we stress test it, which is what's the difference between the issuer issuing its ordinary shares today versus entering into a contract to issue its ordinary shares in the future. We're sort of looking at what's the economic difference between those two things from the issuer's perspective. So that's our starting assumption, which seems logical. But I think one of the things we need to think carefully about is actually our current fix-for-fix criteria doesn't do a terribly good job of that, even if I think about a really simple derivative. So let's say that I have agreed to issue five of my share price today is 100. So if I issued my shares today, I'd get 100 at market. So I'm now going to issue into a derivative where I'm going to agree to issue five of my shares in a year's time. Now, whether I agree to sell those for 5, 10, or 50 billion, we're not going to question that. We're just going to say that's an equity derivative, and it's going to get the same classification, even though the difference between those things is much, could be completely disconnected with passage of time. It's just because I think it's, you know, my view on my future share price, the deal I can strike with the counterparty. We don't question any of those things. So putting simply, I don't say it's fixed for fixed and I'll give you equity classification as long as the only difference between the amount that I'm agreeing to sell my shares for today is just the time value of money, I just don't care. As long as it's just fixed for fixed, it affects the premium, the amount I'll get for the transaction, but it'll allow them to have equity classification. Now, what we're doing, as I understand it, and this is the next point, which is sort of what made me think about it, is that I'm now saying that if, in fact, my derivative would give me the choice to issue my shares in 1 year's time or 2 years' time, and I know the number of shares I'm going to issue and the amount I'm going to get in those two dates, but the counterparty can choose whether it wants to do it in 1 year or 2 year, I'm now going to say I'm going to be okay with that as long as the only thing going on is passage of time. whereas if I'd done those as two separate derivatives, where in 1 year I would have not worried what the amount was, or if it was in 2 years I wouldn't have worried what the amount was, just because it was fixed for fixed, why all of a sudden, because there's two alternatives joined together, are we putting a constraint on the fact that the only difference can be passage of time? And I think maybe it might be because, well, maybe there's another risk that's different between somebody who issues their shares today and issues their shares in the future, which is it may or may not be a good deal at the time that you come to settle. You know for sure that if you issue your shares today at market price, that that's sort of a neutral transaction from the issuer's perspective. As soon as they agree to issue their shares or do something with their shares in the future for a fixed amount, it's introducing another element of something. Is this a good deal or a bad deal relative to the actual share price at the time?
Yeah.
And so I think we just need to think carefully about how good that anchor is, because otherwise how am I indifferent to what the fix for fixed is with my just simple derivative? Yeah? Do you get my point?
Mm-hmm. So I think our assumption is that, I think, as you said, if the depending on where the strike price is set, the entity would have gotten the fair compensation and market value, so therefore it's neutral in
that
sense.
We don't put that constraint on a normal derivative, you see, right? So I could agree to sell Hans my shares in 1 year's time for a tiny amount of money or a huge amount of money, and I'd allow both of those to be equity accounted, right? I don't question whether there's just a passage of time difference between my strike price and my market price in that case, so why do I suddenly care? My instinct is it matters, but I don't think we've got the articulation yet of why, and I think we need to know that to know how to think about that passage of time.
Mm-hmm. Françoise, did you want to get in? You're not on.
Mute?
You're on mute. Okay, try to figure it out. You can come in later. Rika.
Thank you. And I think about the paragraph 27, A and B relationship, I have a similar question about how I can manage to understand is this a supplement to A or not. So that clarification will be helpful. And also about the definition of the passage of time, people can interpret it different ways. So I think I also need that clarification. But in addition to that, I have a question about paragraph 34.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that probability of the any execution should not affect the distinction between equity and liability. So I understand that in the middle of paragraph 34, it said if there is a possibility that the issuer would need to give away more value to derivative holder. Mm-hmm. But this is just a fact. It's not a likelihood or anything, but this is just a fact that whether the issuer is exposed to risk.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. I think, when I'm reading this paragraph, I understand what you intend to, but I think there might be some confusion about anything meaning more in this sentence. So,
yeah, I think we just wanted to make a point that in the case of option or any adjustment that is subject to a contingent event occurring, there is a possibility, and having a possibility is enough for you to having to think about whether the adjustment is either the preservation or passage of time adjustments. But we can make it clear.
Yeah, thank you.
Anne?
I agree with the direction in the paper, and I found the paper really helpful and useful in what you're doing. And I just wanted to comment and ask a question about paragraph 20. So what I understand you're doing is proposing some clarifications, extensions of the principles that we have, and then seeing how they relate to practice problems, and then test them out also further. So when I look at what you identify as the practice questions in A and B around how the requirements should be interpreted and applied, and then secondly, how appropriate the outcomes are, my question is, to what extent are you thinking about transaction structuring when you think about 20 A and B? Because I know that we don't write accounting standards around this behaviour of transaction structuring, and yet for IAS 32, that is one of the big issues that's come. So a couple of questions. You've chosen this area to start with because you said it's one of the most difficult, so I'm assuming it's also one of the areas where we see a lot of transaction structuring, and I think that's what Gary has already referred to today. So do you see our response as clarifying the principles, developing the guidance, which I see as part of A, and through that mechanism is how we will constrain or limit the transaction structuring? Is that the way you see it working?
Yes, I think, yes, that's right. So I think structuring, I think it would be very hard to completely eliminate them, but by providing some principle and underlying rationale, we hope that structuring the extent will reduce compared to what you would have if you just had a series of rules without underlying principles.
Thank you.
Mary?
Supplement to my prior comments, one for a bit of philosophizing about this, and then for maybe some second-order comments to think about wording, expression. And the philosophizing is relevant first because it's about fixed for fixed, in part Sue's comments about in response to Nick's input. I have a feeling, and it isn't more than that, it isn't more substantive than that, that in many ways the expression of fixed for fixed, which ended up as the requirement rather than an illustration, was an operationalization of different thinking that the board had at the time that it introduced that phrase. And it was maybe a somewhat crude tool that was based on some assumptions, like if you issue an option, if the exercise price is higher than today's fair value, that is a rough way of building in, the something that's the passage of time or maybe something more. So I think as we think about supplementing fixed for fixed, Sue was regarding it as, in her comments just now, as an almost sacrosanct, that fixed for fixed would allow a very low exercise price or a really high exercise price, and we would never question the wisdom, question the wisdom of classifying that as equity. And I think if we think about fixed for fixed in IAS 32 today and maybe say it was something to make a concept operational, and it simplified away some of the considerations that are now coming up when it's been in place for a while, I think we'd have to think about how any changes we make would relate to that general both requirement and kind of safe harbor that fixed for fixed provides, and think about whether there's interaction. I wanted to raise that because I also don't want us to fall into doing the same thing as we do supplements. And two of the areas that I wanted to highlight just for you to think about and how you bring them forward are the settlement value notion and the notion that kind of comes up explicitly in the back of the paper about knowing the number and the settlement date value of the shares that would be issued. And if you don't, as the issuer, know that on day one, then that must mean that it doesn't qualify for equity. It comes up in some of your test application of the clarifications to known practice issues. Now, I think if we are going to use kind of mechanical tests like that, which are very helpful in terms of operationalizing principles. We have to both relate them to the principle and kind of put them up front and say, you know, if 27A and B or 27A only, or, you know, whatever form of 27A, 27 we end up with, if this is kind of the core of our clarification, then how does that immediately lead or not lead to that settlement settlement value notion, and how does that then generate the requirement to know the number and value on day one, so that we connect it, so that there's a closer connection between the requirement, you know, the mechanical requirement, the equivalent of fixed for fixed, with what we're aiming for. Because when I look at the paragraph 11 and of this paper, which quotes from IS 32, you know, the paragraph where fixed for fixed is introduced, you can struggle a bit with seeing how the mechanic of fixed for fixed relates to the part that's above. So think about that, and then specifically with settlement value, I'll give you some comments offline just about how we have to think about expressing it, so we don't trip ourselves up with things like the variable value of the option that you tender to exercise it, as an example. And then the last thing, I had agreed and still do with Tadeo that I think the passage of time adjustment is something that's worth exploring, but remembering that this is trying to clarify, improve, and strengthen rather than throw out and redo. If that becomes really, really hard or adds huge amounts of complexity, I think we have to challenge ourselves to say, is that the great being the enemy of the good, and not let it kind of stall the whole project.
Nick?
Thank you. I thought I was okay with this, and I've got confused. So it's really building on what Gary talked about in paragraph 37.
Yes.
And the kind of the quest for a foundation principle. And I think what paragraph 37 is, the foundation principle embedded there, is preserving the value of existing equity holders. But to me, that's not necessarily consistent with what you have in paragraph 27. I just want to be clear. So if I look at those conditions in paragraph 27, it would be quite possible to issue an instrument that would be dilutive to existing holders.
Right.
And so, again, the economics come back to the entity. And I guess the question is issuing new shares today the same as an instrument that would issue new shares in the future? And it's not about to whom the shares are issued.
Yep.
Okay, I just wanted to get it clear that the foundation isn't about dilution. We use that as an exception in terms of thinking about preservation.
Yeah.
But the foundation is what's embedded in paragraph 27.
Yep. I think the way we are thinking about it is, if a company issues a fixed for fixed derivative, you know exactly how many shares you are issuing. And we kind of compare that with what position would you be in, would you have been in, if the underlying shares were issued instead. So that's 27. And when it comes to adjustment, we are seeing that if the board is willing to allow some sort of adjustment, what that boundary should be. And the way we are thinking at the moment is that boundary should be that the issuer is not exposed to or has not promised to give away any more value than it would have promised to the underlying equity holders. So we are still looking at it from what is the obligation that issuer has, but when it comes to adjustment, we thought it was important to compare that against what is the obligation to the underlying equity holder. But we are still looking at it from issuer perspective, and the way we have built it at the moment is that it's the boundary, and if you bridge that boundary, we see that as that's the tipping point and that should become a liability.
Yep.
But that's the current thoughts.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Sue?
Listening to this discussion, again, trying to be helpful, I think that one of the things that actually might be underlying fixed for fixed in 32, which I think is also underlying your thinking, but maybe we can bring it out more because it might be helpful just to throw it out there, is this idea that when it's an equity transaction, The similarity you have between issuing the shares today and doing these transactions is that the entity knows for sure how much it's going to get for its shares. So if I issue shares today, I don't judge whether or not I think it's a good or bad price. In our literature, we just say you've issued your shares, just book the amount you got and call that equity. It could be a high amount, a small amount. There's no sort of is it at fair value type test. And in a similar way, we do that with fixed for fixed, because the similar thing is you know for sure how much you're going to get for your shares, and so it's the counterparty that's taking the risk of whether or not that turns out to be a good or a bad decision, in the sense that I know I'm definitely getting 100.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think that that is part of what... So I'm definitely getting 100, and part of it is I'm not exposed to any other risks, all of this stuff, which is your thinking. But I think that's why we don't really question whether it's a good or a bad deal when we have just a simple fix-for-fix transaction, because I just know for sure I've got a definite amount and I'm not exposed to my own equity price risk anymore either, right? And I think that's fundamental in fix-for-fix. What we then need to test is that if I then know for sure that I'm going to get either 120 next year or 250 in year two, similarly I know for sure, so do I care in a more granular way what's behind the 120 and the 250? And I think the reason we have to think carefully about that is that clever structurers, if we're not careful, create variable by having every day a different price, and then they create all this optionality and mask other things. But I think if we bring that sort of logic in, it might help. And I think it's implicit in here, this basic idea, do I know for sure how much I'm getting, is underlying some of the chat that's in here.
Tom?
Just following up on this discussion about the Bermudan and all this. If I just, in the time value of money, if I started with an option where I had two prices, an earlier price and a later price, and the difference between the earlier price and the later price was pure time value money. We established that. And so I then sell this option and I get, say, a dollar for it. If I were to create something different for that second price, it's either higher than the basic time value money or it's lower, then how much would people pay me for that option? Would it be higher or lower than a dollar? Well, if the other subsequent price is higher, they're going to pay me less than a dollar, because we have less chance of cashing. If it's lower, they're going to pay me more than a dollar. And it just kind of goes to Sue's idea about what's a fair deal. When you issue the option, you get some money in. And if all it had was a time value of money versus something that's less than a time value of money, then the whole deal is what you got it when you sold the thing plus what you're going to get when they cash it. And I think when we think about it, I think Sue's right that one of the reasons that drove us was to try and get what was the fair deal. Mm-hmm. But once we have the instrument out there, how much we received for it is gone into the rearview mirror. It's not even in the rear, it's just gone. Okay. And so what we're left is only part of the transaction. And to say that that is a fair deal as a standalone proposition may be difficult, because it was a fair deal when you got the extra initial amount at the beginning and you have an option that's worth less later. And I think that might, again, be something to think about and problematic, because what you're always left with is just the option in the hand, and the amount they paid is in the past.
The challenge is we never test if it is a fair deal, right? Mm. We don't worry, because we just assume the market works, and therefore you might get a smaller or a higher premium depending on...
Yeah.
Okay. Any other comments? Yes, Françoise. You're still not... We still cannot hear you. Is there any problem on our side? Yeah. You managed to switch yourself off, so you should be able to switch yourself on again, too.
All right. Tom wants to come back in. Tom's first card.
One...
After Berner?
Yes. Well, no, just a small comment. At the end of the day, when we did the conceptual framework, there's two paragraphs that says we're waiting on this project. And the way we're structuring it now, we may never get back to answering those two paragraphs in the conceptual. So I just wanted to mention that that's a desirable... I think we could do the project without answering those paragraphs, but we should keep that in mind as we go through. And to that end, I would state that when they tried to apply back in 95 the conceptual framework, clean, all these things ended up equity, and then there was all kinds of structuring, so we came back with the 99 and the 2003 changes. And what we have in 32 is an expansion of the definition of liability as it appears in the conceptual framework. The expansion does not come from the fix-for-fix condition. The expansion comes from the variable part. That's what expands. And that's where, if you're looking with respect to 32, with respect to a major fundamental principle relative to the conceptual framework, it's in the variable. The fix-for-fix, in fact, you could not have it at all. The conceptual framework would tell you it's an equity without that. And so I just, again, I think it's something to keep in mind if we are in the end going to try back to conceptual framework. I don't think we should do it on an issue-by-issue basis, but I think just keep in mind, and it's something that we should think about it when we come to the end of this process.
Has this discussion been helpful?
Yes, it has.
Lots to think about. Thank you very much.
But you don't feel shaken in the foundations of your thinking this way. Okay, very good. Okay, we are trying to move some other topics forward. Why don't we take a break till 5 past 11 and then resume? Also, just be.